Money, rights, and the value of nothing.
If you have a lot of money, you have the right to do whatever you like. You have the right to have rights. You have the right to good health care. You have the right to good education, or the right to housing, or the right to food. But if you have no money, then freedom is another word for nothing that you can afford.
That's Raj Patel. We'll talk to him about reshaping market society and redefining democracy. His book is The Value of Nothing.
The images we receive of Africa in this country are so distorted that we thought it important to set the record straight. All you see is civil war, it is displacement, it is refugees, it is famine. Yes, we do have those, but we also have a heroic Africa that is struggling every day.
And that's Samba Gajigo, professor of film at Mount Holyoke College. Later in the show, he'll tell us about his community-based learning project, Africa Through African Eyes. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In an interview during the 2008 presidential campaign, Barack Obama declared, quote, "I'm a pro-growth, free market guy. I love the market. I think it's the best invention to allocate resources and produce enormous prosperity for America or the world that's ever been designed." Well, with over a year of double-digit unemployment and that great sucking sound of U.S. taxpayer dollars being allocated to the Wall Street banks who got us into this mess, maybe it's time to take another look at the market, at least as we know it under modern U.S.-style capitalism. That's what my guest Raj Patel does in his latest book, The Value of Nothing. He says we're actually operating under a kind of anti-market now, where nothing is important beyond the short-term bottom line of those who own and control society's financial resources. And the game is rigged against the rest of us. He says our idea that the market turns individual greed and selfishness into a social good is misplaced. Instead, it's destroying the value of human capital, our democracy, our environment, and our future. But Raj Patel says there's hope, another way that recognizes cooperation, more local control of resources, and the balancing of human needs with economic gain. In other words, markets that work for everyone. Raj Patel has worked for the World Bank and the World Trade Organization, as well as protested against them. He's currently a visiting scholar at UC Berkeley Center for African Studies and a fellow at the Institute for Food and Development Policy, also known as Food First. His first book was Stuffed and Starved, The Hidden Battle for the World Food System. His current book, The Value of Nothing, is on the New York Times bestseller list. Raj Patel, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's great to be here, Francesca.
In your book, The Value of Nothing, you give an example, an emblematic story. I think it's emblematic because it really gets to the heart of the idea of how value is decided in our society. It's about a memo by Larry Summers, who is now director of Obama's National Economic Council. But this was a memo that he wrote and that was secretly leaked while he was at the World Bank, which you also worked at for a term. And it was about toxic waste. Tell us about the memo.
Well, yes, this is a memo that did cause a bit of a furore when it was released. And it was a memo that Larry Summers wrote, I mean, if one believes him, as a kind of tongue-in-cheek thing. But what he was saying was that, given income levels and preferences in developing countries, shouldn't developing countries be more polluted, because the preferences of the people in developing countries would be rather to have cash that was accrued through toxic waste dumping than to have a better environment. And you're right, this kind of cuts straight to the heart of how it is that we value things. By putting a dollar value on pollution, this would be one of the ways in which people could make money, by accepting toxic waste. And what's interesting about this memo, of course, is that there's been a very interesting blowback. If one thinks about Somali piracy, for example, when we hear a lot about Somali pirates, what some of the pirates are saying is, actually, we pirates are responding to the fact that Europe has been dumping its toxic waste just off the shore here for a very long time. And with the tsunami in 2002, was it? Possibly 2004, I can't quite remember the date. When the tsunami happened, these barrels of toxic waste washed up on Somali shores and people started falling ill. And as a result of that, and given that there was no money available for hospitals, pirates said, well, actually, one of the reasons why we're out hijacking marine transport is so that we can afford basic things like healthcare for the people who have suffered and died as a result of the pollution being dumped on our doorstep. And this is a very interesting example of how it is that decisions get made in economics. I mean, one of the things I talk about in the books is, although economics is about decisions, it's never really said who gets to make them. And when Larry Summers gets to make decisions, he doesn't have to suffer the consequences. And the consequences that were suffered in Somalia, for example, are ones that are now being spread around the world in terms of piracy and hijacking and the consequences thereof.
You also say in the book that money, we talk about money and capitalism being about freedom. I think there's a conflation of the idea of capitalism and freedom, the market and freedom, all these individuals who are out, who have the freedom to maximize their own benefits, their own welfare. But you point out that, money is the right to have rights. And freedom is another word for nothing that you can afford. And in this case, you'd say something about the Somali villagers.
Well, that's it. I mean, let's take the step back, because a lot of people do think that the free in free market implies a certain kind of liberty, a certain kind of freedom. And it's important to understand what kind of freedom that is. And so I talk about the thought experiment that the late Oxford philosopher Jerry Cohen came up with. And he said, look, if you think markets are about freedom, think about this. Imagine a world not where we have money and free markets, but where we have tickets. And some people have a lot of tickets, and a few people, some people have very few tickets. Now, on these tickets are things that you can do. You can have health care. You can have, you can work in a good-paying job. You can live in a house. You can eat a good square meal. You can live without fear of being attacked in the street. Now, we would say that the people who have more tickets would have more freedoms, more rights than people who have fewer tickets. Because if you don't have a ticket to have a square meal and you try and eat, then the police will intervene. Now, what Jerry Cohen says is, look, actually, in this world where some people have a lot of rights and some people have very few rights, that's kind of like the world we live in today. But instead of tickets, we have money. And if you have a lot of money, you have the right to do whatever you like. You have the right to have rights. You have the right to good health care. You have the right to enjoy the right to good education or the right to housing or the right to food. But if you have no money, then freedom is another word for nothing that you can afford. And of course, when it comes back to the villagers in Somalia who are affected by pollution that we have caused, they live the consequences of our freedom. They live the consequences of the way that we have consumed and managed to offshore the consequences of our freedom onto their doorstep. And there's something very systematic about that. There's a way in which we in rich countries consume today that dumps costs on developing countries and denies them freedom. And there was a study last year in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that actually took this idea of the way we remove freedoms through the market in developing countries quite seriously. And they said, look, if we were to pay for all the environmental damage that we have caused developing countries, how much would we have, what would we owe over the past, say, 40 years, over just basically six very simple dimensions of climate change and overfishing and these kinds of things? And the amount that we owe developing countries ends up being anywhere up to $6 trillion. And that's a measure of the dollar freedom that we have removed from developing countries and which we have amassed as a consequence of the way that we consume today.
So, in a way, the only right that they get to have is the right to accept our toxic waste.
Exactly. And, of course, the worst of it would be the right to accept our toxic waste and then for us to call it development, for us to think that we're doing them a favor.
Right. I wonder if you could apply this idea of money as rights to the recent Supreme Court ruling that gave the rights of free speech, individual rights of free speech, to corporations. What does that do to the individual rights of actual human beings?
Well, I talk in the book about this idea of corporate personhood, about how it is that corporations have come to have the rights of individuals, the rights of, you know, the right of free speech, the right to avoid self-incrimination. It is obviously absurd in many ways that we should allow corporations the same rights as individuals, because although corporations cannot vote, they are now allowed virtually unlimited amounts of freedom to spend. And again, in a free market like the one that we have, where money equals the right to have your voice heard, and the very rich get to amplify their voices way beyond the ability of the very poor, then what we've basically done is given corporations carte blanche to become the loudest voices in our economy, loudest voices not only in our economy, but in our democracy as well. It's obviously tremendously dangerous, because if the ability to make your voice heard is contingent on being able to buy airtime and to be able to shape the news agenda through excessive spending, then the people with the most money are the most free. And the absurd thing, of course, is that we've allowed corporations to become people, and we've allowed the richest corporations to be richer than many countries. And when you have those corporations throwing their weight around in our democracy, that's a very, very bad sign for actually what it means for real freedom of speech and the freedom of a democratic process to impede unhindered and unmolested by the interests of the powerful.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're speaking with Raj Patel about his latest book, The Value of Nothing. It's about how we can reshape our market system to foster democracy and create a better, more cooperative world. Yeah. Now, Raj Patel, you, in talking about markets, you angle in on the very assumptions underlying markets and how we think about markets today, assumptions that I think are taken as natural by many people. You know, it's just kind of the way things are. It doesn't seem without human agency. One of those ideas is efficiency. You hear a lot, and I hear a lot, because I write about sustainability and corporate social responsibility. A lot of people say markets are the best way to, you know, change things for the better. The idea that somehow the efficiency of the markets will make sure that poor solutions drop away and good solutions come in instead. I wonder if you could talk about that. Are markets really efficient?
Well, I mean, I like markets. I think that in any future, I don't want anyone else deciding, you know, what I eat or what I wear or any of these kinds of things. I mean, I think markets are a great way of decentralizing decision making. But the way that we've set up modern capitalism isn't terribly efficient, because what we've allowed to happen is the concentration of power in the hands of a very few entities, who then shape the rules of the game to favor them, to increase their profits, rather than to use resources efficiently. I talk in the book about how, actually, if you like markets, if you like free exchange, if you like, you know, the idea of being able to negotiate and be able to let markets do what they do best, which is, you know, decentralizing decision making and communicating scarcity at a local level, then what we have at the moment is the anti-market. Because the way that the markets and the way that capitalism has proceeded so far, we are living, to use Lord Nicholas Stern's ideas when he's in his report on climate change, we are living in the middle of the greatest market failure in human history. Because the way that markets have failed to, you know, worry about the environmental cost of their actions and failed to worry about the future is indicative of, you know, the way that corporations work, of the way the profit cycles work, where you only have to worry about the next quarter's reporting rather than to worry about anything that might affect, you know, a period of time beyond that or even the future. But then the argument comes back, well, all right, look, if markets are so bad, what do you replace them with? Is there anything more efficient? And this is where some other ideas come out that do rest on very different premises. At the moment, we believe that markets work because if people behave in an entirely selfish way and self-interested way, that resources will be allocated most efficiently. But actually, it turns out that people are not merely selfish individuals. This is an assumption on which markets work, but it's not an assumption that actually reflects how we are in real life. And if you look at some of the ways in which people have cooperated to manage resources, it's possible to see, as was done in a study last year in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, that actually when communities are given freedom to be able to manage their own resources and enough resources for them to be able to survive on, that communities do better. And there was a study of 80 forest communities done in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences where where researchers looked at those communities, looked at how free they were, looked at how much forest they had to manage. And they found out that communities that were given freedom and enough resources not only did better for the communities that were involved, but actually sequestered more carbon. In other words, they managed the resource of the forest way better than letting free markets or governments in. And I think that should give us pause. That should help us realize that there are other ways of valuing things other than by throwing them into a market and letting corporations decide.
Now, are these individuals who had individual ownership rights in this forest, or was this a collective ownership?
Well, it was about a communal ownership of resources. Now, that may sound weird and freaky, but bear in mind that before capitalism happened, systems of the commons had to be destroyed. I mean, this is certainly where in England where capitalism really began. Part of the origins of capitalism lie in the destruction of the commons, of something that was owned not by an individual, but held held by a community as a domain in which they could exercise a political control over. And again, I mean, it's weird to think about that, because we've been we've all been brought up certainly with the idea of the tragedy of the commons, the idea that if we have a resource that isn't owned by any one individual, then because all of us are selfish, we will use that resource until there is nothing left. This is the idea of the tragedy of the commons, where because we are selfish, we will use a resource, and with eyes wide open, we will destroy the resource on which we depend. That's the tragedy of it. But actually, ideas of property and private property have always been a little more malleable and a little more flexible than we believe in the United States today, where the right of private property seems to be trumping anything else. I mean, even back in the day, when John Locke was writing, for example, this idea of natural right still obtained. And the idea of natural right said, among other things, that if you were hungry and someone else had food, it would be all right for you to to steal that food for your family, to feed your family, because the rights of your family to be free of hunger would trump any individual's right to private property. We've kind of lost that idea now.
In Haiti, where people are called looters.
Right, exactly. And of course, who of us wouldn't, if we saw food lying around and we heard the cries of our hungry children, would not take that food and bring it to our children? And of course, the way that this was reported in Katrina gives you a sense of how the media works, where when white people are doing it, it's called feeding your family, but when people of color do it, it's called looting.
So let's unpack this a little bit more, this idea of the commons. I mean, here in New England, where we produce the show, we're pretty familiar with the commons. I'm doing the show here in Amherst. We have an Amherst Commons. Where I live, we have a commons. And certainly this was not a communist society, even from the beginning when people had commons. So what's your idea of being able to blend the idea of markets with the idea of certain things held in common? For example, our atmosphere.
Well, actually, I mean, the atmosphere is often the hardest place to go, because I mean, essentially all of us need to be around the table to value that atmosphere. And unfortunately, as we saw in Copenhagen, the governments that are sometimes democratically and invariably not democratically elected are very bad at representing the wishes of ordinary people. And so for me, I mean, I think we need to reclaim those governments so that they do better represent our demands and our interests. There are things that we can do, I mean, in the interim, if we're concerned about polluting the atmosphere as we should be. It's certainly having caps on the amount of carbon that we produce in our country, in the United States, for example, so that we do move to as swiftly as possible to our fair share towards an atmosphere that has 350 parts per million of carbon. I think that's a tremendously important and urgent way forward. And if people are interested in that, then 350.org is the place to go to find out more. But for me, if we're thinking about the commons, actually, one of the things about the commons is living with the consequences of your actions, living so that you actually have a feedback mechanism, so that when you behave sustainably, you reap the rewards of that. And when you behave unsustainably, you get some feedback about how unsustainable you're being so that you can change the way that you behave. And one of the ways of doing that is actually, for me, around food, around the issue of how it is that we eat in the United States. Because, I mean, certainly at the moment, we are eating unsustainably. But one of the exciting things that's happening in the food movement in North America is the rise of food policy councils, of democratic spaces that are better matched to the, you know, to the food shed, to the ecological footprint of the way that we consume. And when, you know, our ecological footprint and our political footprint are the same size, more or less, we have a much better sense, a much better chance of living within our means. And that's one of the, you know, the defining features of the commons, is actually having democratic structures that also match the ecological structures in which we live and work. And so while the atmosphere is, you know, a global problem and one that, that, you know, needs to be tackled, for me, a good place to start building the practice of democracy, of everyday democracy, is around managing the way that we eat sustainably within our community.
Raj Patel, in your book, The Value of Nothing, you have an example, I think, of this, which is a really nice one, and that is about Chilean fishing communities who developed a system of TURF, T-U-R-F, and now I don't remember what that stands for. Is this an example of what you're talking about?
Well, to some extent, yes. I mean, it's interesting, just to frame the problem, it's interesting and important to note that we are emptying the oceans. We are destroying the seas on which we depend for marine life and also for our ecosystem. And, you know, more and more reports are pointing to the extinction not only of commercial fishing, but I mean, in some cases, of entire ecosystems because of the way that we pollute water and overfish. Now, that overfishing doesn't happen because fishing communities are doing it. It happens because we allow large trawlers and large corporate fishing fleets to empty the oceans, and you know, where the domains on in which we allow fishing to happen are basically given away for free. One of the responses to managing that has been to put restrictions on you know, these large-scale capitalist fishing enterprises and instead rely on other ways of managing water resources sustainably. Quotas for fishing have tended to be escaped, and you know, the idea of fishing quotas and a limit to catches usually encourage cheating. But tying a certain amount of fishing rights to a particular territory, to actually grounding it into a particular place, into a particular ecosystem, seems to be doing well. And there's something called the territorial use rights in fishing, which are essentially sort of fishing permits bound to a particular place, given to particular communities to distribute among themselves. Now, those kinds of use rights that are essentially sort of, you know, in some ways an updating of the idea of the commons, well, those kinds of rights actually seem to be doing well. They seem to be encouraging sustainable fishing among fishing communities. It allows those fishing communities to stand a chance against commercial trawlers. It allows resources to be replenished within the fishing terrain in which those communities operate without it being prejudiced by large-scale fishing from outside. So there are ways in which, you know, in our modern world, we can use some of the ideas of the commons to think about and manage sustainably the resources, you know, on which we all depend.
So how would that work, for example, in the New England fishing industry? Here we have, you know, real collapse of the cod fishing. You know, would like to bring that back. There are restrictions on fishing. We've got a lot of local fishing communities. Are you saying that if it was given over to smaller scale producers, let's say, that there would be more likelihood to preserve a resource, that the real problem are these kind of factory fish boats? Because a lot of these local fisher people are really, they're up in arms about the limits.
And I can understand that, of course. But, I mean, there's also an extent to which, I mean, if people aren't given control over resources that they know that they will depend on, and I mean, certainly the fishing communities that I've worked with, for example, when I speak to people who are part of the World Forum on Fisherfolk, they are very well aware of the sort of limits to how much they can catch to keep their fishing grounds sustainable. They're very aware of limits, you know, of the need to limit the amount that they catch in order that there be enough stock for, you know, so that people can fish next year. And what they're concerned about is the arrival of external fishing, unsustainable external fishing organizations and corporations that plunder the resources without having to live with the consequences. You know, overfishing is just a tremendous problem. But I think that one of the ways out of that is not to hand over the keys to large corporations to be able to manage this effectively. But I do think that communities who are forced to live with the consequences of their economic actions do much better than communities who have other people's consequences dumped on their doorstep, or who in other ways manage to escape the consequences of their actions.
Raj Patel, in your book, The Value of Nothing, you spend a lot of time talking about how there are other forms of value that are being crowded out by the marketplace. You've talked about well-being indexes, for example. You know, you say money makes us happier, but only up to a certain point. And after we have our needs met, then every additional dollar brings you less amount of happiness per unit of the money. One of the most interesting alternatives to the gross domestic product as a measure of well-being, of economic well-being, is what you call a gender empowerment measure. I wonder if you could talk about that for a minute and why.
Sure. I mean, pretty much everyone sees how this idea of gross domestic product is a terrifically bad way of measuring how well people are doing. All it is a measure of economic activity, and unfortunately, we've allowed it to become a proxy for how well how well a country is doing. Even though, you know, in the U.S., part of our a big chunk of our gross domestic product is the spending on healthcare that results from having a spectacularly expensive healthcare system, or the spending on weapons, which comes from having an immense army, the largest the largest military force on earth. And, of course, that's no measure of the security that we gain or lose by having that, a huge military. But one of the things that's missing from gross domestic product, one of the things that isn't valued at all, is women's work. And this isn't an accident of the way that capitalism works. In the same way that nature provides a subsidy to the way that we consume today, women's work also provides a subsidy to the way that we consume today. And in the book, I sort of say, I cite a UN study that was done in 1995, looking at if women's unpaid work in the home, like around taking care of children, around educating kids, around building community, around growing food, about producing food for the market and for home consumption, if all of that were to have a dollar value attached to it, what would that dollar value be? And the total of women's work in 1995, memory serves, as $16 trillion. That's pretty much half of the total value that's counted as gross domestic product. So there's a huge chunk of the way that we measure the world today that doesn't count women's work, for example. And so if we are to broaden the way in which we think about the world today and think about our happiness and think about the circumstances in which we find ourselves, we need many more dimensions to think about the world than just the money that's being turned over and over in our economy. The country of Bhutan has dozens and dozens of metrics that go into something called an index of gross national happiness, gross domestic happiness. But one of those elements is an indication of gender empowerment, of the way in which women are free to contribute and free to exercise their rights in an economy. Because, as I say, the way that we count women's work in the economy is systematically undervaluing the way that our economy depends on women's work. And a measurement of women's empowerment and an index of gender empowerment is going to be vital if we're going to see the world in much richer ways than the kind of broken glass, through the broken prism of dollar value.
Raj Patel, the book is The Value of Nothing. Stay tuned for more of our interview after the break.
The fisherman comes up, puts his two poles in the sand. He stares out at the sea, just exactly like me. But I've got a book in my hand. We will have caught on to something by the end of the day.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Just before the break, our guest Raj Patel was talking about how the work of women is undervalued in our current market system, even though women do much of the labor that feeds and keeps their families alive. In his book, The Value of Nothing, he talks about the worldwide peasant organization La Via Campesina. It came out with a platform that put ending violence against women at the top of its agenda for what it calls food sovereignty. I asked Raj Patel to tell us about La Via Campesina.
La Via Campesina is an international peasant movement of 150 million small farmers, landless workers, and campesinos. And they are really worldwide. I mean, here in the United States, we have the National Family Farm Coalition, who are a member of La Via Campesina. But they also include, you know, landless workers in Brazil and millions of farmers in India. And they were formed because, in many ways, the poorest people on earth are involved in farming, and particularly in farm labor. And their voices counted for very little when farming policy was being decided by, you know, national governments or the World Bank imposing various kinds of economic policy on developing countries. And what they were demanding is the right to be able to shape food and agriculture policy. That's what food sovereignty means. Food sovereignty is just about a demand that people have democracy in the way that food, you know, food policy is shaped. In other words, it's about a right to have rights. And that's important because, again, we were talking earlier on about how, in fact, in the free market, money is the right to have rights. And what Via Campesina is saying is actually, well, you know, what we want is a much more democratic way of having rights. We want the rights to have rights just through democratic process rather than through being rich. And so they evolved this definition, and they've been working on it. They've been working on the practice of, you know, bringing democracy to our food system. And part of that involves a realization that up and down the food system, there are inequalities in power. And if we're going to have a functioning democracy, then actually we need those inequalities in power to be leveled. And that's why, for example, you know, we're thinking about the ruling on corporations being allowed to have a voice in politics. That opens up a very profound inequality in power. But what Via Campesina is saying is actually we need to tackle inequalities in power so that everyone can behave in a democratic way equally, up and down, you know, the scales of politics, from the international level, from the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, right down to the household level, because it is also in the household where decisions around food, around justice, around distribution are made, and in which women are systematically disadvantaged. And this happens not just through domestic violence, but through the structural violence of the way that our economy operates. So, you know, the fact that women are unpaid for domestic work is just an example of how the way that we value things today militates against women. I mean, in developing countries, most of the food that is grown, that is eaten in developing countries, is grown by women. And yet, you know, women have by far less economic power and power in government and society than their economic activity suggests. And so what La Via Campesina says is, you know, if we're going to have a right to have rights, if we're going to have a democratic discussion, in our case, around food and agriculture policy, then we need to tackle those inequalities. And that's why they say that food sovereignty, a democratic discussion around food, is about an end to all forms of violence against women. And again, you know, it's a remarkable bit of sort of political, practical political theory, where, you know, by looking at how the world actually works and looking at how injustice manifests itself in the world today, these, you know, the poorest people on earth, peasants, you know, a word that is often synonymous with being ignorant. These peasants are saying, actually, you know, we need to tackle the violence that women, for women being unrecognized for the work that they do domestically. We need to recognize the violence of not being able to send your daughter to school because she's needed to work in the field. The violence of not being able to sell your product on the open market because Europe or the United States have dumped their products below market cost, and you're driven out and you're denied the dignity to enter a market freely. And so this idea of fighting inequality in power is something that I think is tremendously important and salutary if we're going to understand how democracy actually works, in particular, you know, a democracy that allows markets to thrive.
One of the places where food was dumped on the local market and decimated the local food industry is Haiti, which is now, of course, being suffering the terrible aftermath of a terrific earthquake, of a horrendous earthquake, where U.S. food aid came in and really kind of decimated the ability of local farmers to grow rice, the local rice growing industry. Looking forward to the potential for Haiti to develop, to come back from this earthquake, and maybe even to provide an example, if it could provide an example of the right way of doing things, what would work? What system of valuing, what system of market relations, what system of democracy, and putting these all together, how would it work to create a food system in Haiti that was really sustainable?
Well, of course, you know, there's a tremendous amount of damage that has already been done, and you know that is due in no small part to our export of so-called free markets to Haiti. And it's important for people to remember that one of the reasons Haiti was already a disaster before this earthquake is because of U.S. Engagement and the imposition of structural adjustment policies that made Haitian farmers basically put them out of business and made Haiti dependent on U.S. rice, U.S. rice imports. And those structural adjustment policies were introduced by Presidents Reagan and Clinton. And then, of course, President Bush was responsible for deposing a democratically elected representative in Haiti. In the process of reconstruction, it is horrifying to see Presidents Clinton and Bush as U.S. emissaries for raising aid when they were in many ways responsible for destroying the economy and democracy of Haiti. It's like sending horsemen of the apocalypse to a peace conference. But I think what we need to be doing is allowing Haitians to make the decisions for themselves. Haiti is the great place of people making decisions for themselves. I mean, this was the site of the first slave rebellion, for which, of course, Haiti has been punished ever since. And I worry about the prospects of Haitian recovery when the powers meeting in Montreal and Davos are conspiring ways of introducing the best practices in aid. The people around the table, the entities like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, have no experience in allowing democracy to flourish. I mean, the whole point of a structural adjustment loan is that it is policies that the government has to accept despite the objections of its people, because the government needs the loan in order to be able to escape bankruptcy. I mean, the real tragedy is that Haitians have, for a very long time, known what they want. They've had a democracy. They've elected representatives who have demanded things like reparations for slavery and wanted to invest in healthcare and invest in education and in farming. But they've been denied the right to do that by the United States and by other donor countries. So, I mean, in terms of Haiti, there are loads of ideas about reconstruction that would work and loads of democratic practices and traditions that are already alive and well in Haiti. In many ways, what we have to do is just get the hell out of the way and allow our money to be spent, firstly, in terms of reparations for the damage we've already done to Haiti, but allow a democratically elected Haitian government to make the decisions that the Haitian people are demanding, rather than for us to come in with any kind of model and imposing it on the people of Haiti, because that would just perpetuate a long reign of our mistakes being borne by the Haitian people.
It sounds like one of the ideas that you suggest in the book, participatory budgeting, would work here for Haiti. I think it would also work for the towns and cities here in Western Massachusetts that are being squeezed of their income by the state. I mean, we don't have any possibility of doing it, of democratic decision-making around budgets. Tell us, what is participatory budgeting?
This is an idea that was born in Brazil from citizens who wanted more control and more accountability from their local municipal government. And so through the Workers' Party, the Workers' Party was elected on this mandate of bringing budgeting to the people. And basically the idea is that there's a large chunk of the government's, the city's annual budget that is decided not by bureaucrats or not even by elected officials, but by the people themselves. And so what you have in the rich neighborhoods and in the poorest slums is people getting together and discussing how it is that they want the government's budget to be spent, about, you know, what should be the priority, where should the hospital go, who should get the playground first, you know, the very practical, very real decisions. And this becomes a way of people becoming more engaged in their community budget and more actually, you know, owning government better. And it wasn't dependent on a particular party. In fact, the Workers' Party has been voted out in some of these communities. But participatory budgeting remains as a really effective way of getting people to make decisions around their community. Now, I don't see this as a panacea. I think it's entirely possible in some fairly dire circumstances for participatory budgeting to be used to get people to swallow some unpleasant truths that they can do something about. So in other words, if you're being denied a budget, participatory budgeting can sometimes just be a way of getting you to cope with your reduced circumstances and a way of government shuffling off its responsibilities. But at its best, what participatory budgeting does is provide a platform for other kinds of democratic organizing so that we can make demands of state and national governments. And so, in other words, one of the reasons to celebrate participatory budgeting is not merely for the control that it puts in the hands of ordinary people, but for the taste of real democracy that helps to give us. That's certainly one of the arguments I make in the book, is that what we live in today in the United States is less a democracy than a complainocracy, where, you know, we have the choice between two parties, and if one disappoints us, we'll elect another. But their policies are so interchangeable in many ways that actually what we're doing is merely, you know, changing, you know, rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, or, you know, choosing between Coke and Pepsi, and not really making important democratic decisions about the way that we work. And in the book, I talk about how actually, if we look to the origins of the word democracy, it's a very different picture from the one we have in classical Athens. You know, for all its problems, you know, its slavery, its sexism, there was something very interesting about how democracy operated there. And it operated without elections. In other words, you know, the origins of democracy had nothing to do with elections. It had everything to do with citizens taking responsibility for their city. And the way it worked is that at the beginning of every year, 6,000 people were chosen at random through lottery to govern the city. And, you know, they would govern in groups of 500, 12 groups of 500 for a year. And then they would be disbanded, and then, you know, there would be another lottery, and another 6,000 people would govern the city. And there, you know, there was no higher power. Those 6,000 citizens were the law. And if you didn't want to do that, then you were considered an idiot, or idiota, as the original Greek term. And that's a very different kind of democracy from the one we have today, obviously. I mean, its pale vestige is in the jury system. But in pretty much every other way, we are discouraged from taking political responsibility for ourselves and holding, you know, one another and our governments accountable. And I think that if we are to value things without resorting to markets, if we are to reclaim our governments from the corporations that clearly own them, then we need to take back that democracy by becoming far more engaged Democrats.
Well, Raj Patel, we have only skimmed over the surface of this short but really profound book, The Value of Nothing, and I urge our listeners to read it. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much, Francesca.
Raj Patel. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to an interview I did with Raj Patel about his first book, Stuffed and Starved. Next up, we talk with Samba Gajigo about Africa through African eyes. Samba Gajigo is a filmmaker, an expert on African film, and a professor at Mount Holyoke College. He's long been disturbed by the popular images of Africa we get in the American media, images dominated by disaster and suffering on a continent-wide scale. Gajigo says that while Africa has challenges, it also has everyday heroes who are working to meet them. Heroes like the market women who join microfinance networks to build their small businesses, or other women who are working to end female genital mutilation in their communities. Samba Gajigo's spearheaded what he calls a community-based model of learning to show America, Africa through African eyes. It combines talks, films, music, and art exhibits, all based at or near the Westfield State College campus in Massachusetts. The project is running through the month of February, and you can find out more by calling Dr. Elise Young of the History Department at 413-572-8237, and we'll repeat that number later on. Samba Gajigo came into the WMUA studios to talk about Africa through African eyes. Samba Gajigo, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for inviting me.
So tell us about this Africa Through African Eyes. What is this project about?
Africa Through African Eyes is a very, very important project which was initiated by Professor Elise Young of Westfield State College, which basically, as the title indicates, is to bring the American audience, the American public, bring them a certain image of Africa, which is not filtered through the eyes of the Western media, but rather through the eyes of African filmmakers, African artists, African writers, because I think there is an urgency there, because the images we receive of Africa in this country are so distorted that we thought it important to set the record straight. Sure, indeed, we have our share of misery, our share of trouble, but it's also a very dynamic, vibrant continent in which people are really working very hard to get out of the situation in which they are, which, of course, you don't see here in the Western media. All you see is civil war, it is displacement, it is refugees, it is famine. Yes, we do have those, but we also have a heroic Africa that is, as I'm saying, struggling every day, like in every other continent.
A heroic Africa.
Yes. What one of our maestros call the heroism of everyday life, like the heroes you don't see on television, your heroes you don't hear on the radio, but who are devoting their lives every day to improving lives in Africa, to bringing a certain measure of development to Africa. Those you never hear about. You only hear those who are about those who are at the bottom of the pit. I just came back from Senegal about 2 weeks ago. What I call really heroism of everyday life is not just an empty concept. Every corner of a street, you find a woman sitting, selling peanuts, grilling them and selling them to buy textbooks for a child. That's a hero for me.
Why do you think that there's such, as you say, such a contrast between Western ideas of the place of African women and the actual position?
Well, you have some kind of imbalance in the stream of information. And the few images we have, once again, are sensational images, which are only shown when there are major catastrophic events in Africa. What I'm saying is that those catastrophes do exist, but on a daily basis, it is not a country, it is not a continent that is mired in catastrophe. There are very, very positive things happening nowadays in Africa.
And so give us an example of one of those positive things involving African rural women.
Okay, for instance, 10 years ago, you would never have thought of having an African woman, for instance, play a very important role in the political establishment. Nowadays, you go to Senegal, for instance, which I know better, in the National Assembly, you have women. In the administration, you have women. You have women who do farming. You have women who are in the education. Now, I'm not trying to idealize the situation. There is still a lot to be done. In many of the societies, of course, you still have the patriarchal system. But a lot of progress has been done when it comes to African women. For instance, they have created a lot of microfinance, for instance, and lending and development, farming in Africa. So I think that's a very, very important progress.
Do you have a story you could share with us?
Yes. That's, for instance, the evolution of the African woman. There is a very, very interesting film that was made in 1976. It is called Cheddo. Cheddo means in the Wolof language, a rebel, which shows exactly.
It means what?
A rebel, someone who goes against the grain.
In what language? From what country?
In Wolof, from Senegal. Mm-hmm. What the film really deconstructs, again, is our view that it is really the West or the East that is going to free African women. What the film shows is that actually many African societies were matriarchal societies before Christianization and before Islamization. Women were rulers. Go, for instance, to Côte d'Ivoire, for instance. You have the Queen Poku, who was the leader, right, of their people there in Côte d'Ivoire. You go to Senegal in Wolof society, you have a lot of women rulers, again, before Islamization, which imposed patriarchy, replaced it by matriarchy. So I think all those are examples that are not known here in the West. All we see, again, is Western NGOs. Now, I'm not against NGOs. I think some of them do a fantastic work. But I think the development, the future of Africa does not rest alone on the intervention of outside forces. When I talk about heroism of everyday life, it is not just women. It's women and men who are really working very hard to develop the continent.
And we're talking with Dr. Samba Gajigo. He's a filmmaker and professor of film at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. And we're talking about the events going on through the month of February, a project being put on at Westfield State College called Africa Through African Eyes. You know, I think one of the images that Americans have of African women is as victims of female genital mutilation. Mm-hmm. You know, something that may be widespread among more Islamic countries or Islamic communities there. And yet what you're saying right now brings a very different idea. You know, that seems to be the pinnacle. FGM is like the pinnacle of oppression, mm-hmm, of women. So talk about the contrast between that and what you just spoke about, the position of women as leaders in their community.
Yes, I think FGM, you are right, is one really of the plagues in the continent right now. It has been there a long, long time. And to tell you the truth, I think the first writings that were found about female genital mutilation go back to the writings of Herodotus, meaning it was not yesterday. In many Africa, out of the continent of over 53 countries, still in 38 countries, female genital mutilation is practiced. And the degree varies from country to country, of course, from region to region. You have also what is called infibulation. I don't want to be very graphic about it, but if you take, for instance, the Horn of Africa, excision, FGM, is doubled with infibulation, which is a more severe form of really the aggression on the woman's body. We have been dealing with those issues in Africa even before the intervention of Western NGOs. Now, to set the record straight, I know of few NGOs who have been doing wonderful job. You have TOSTAN, which is run by an American woman who is originally from Illinois, who is settled now in Senegal.
And spell that?
TOSTAN is TOSTANE. And then you have Equality Now, which is an NGO based in New York City. And then you also have Forward, which is an NGO which is based in London. I mean, those really organizations have played a very, very important role. But also, I think many African governments are also being very, very proactive in terms of voting legislation to outlaw the practice of female genital mutilation. It's one thing to legislate. It's another thing to eradicate, what you need is education. And there is a lot of education going on right now on the African continent to eradicate female genital mutilation. Because if you just legislate and criminalize, it goes underground and becomes worse.
And so are there women, African women themselves, who are taking the lead on this in their communities?
Yes, there are. And again, you go to my village, for instance, which is in eastern Senegal. Systematically, 20 years ago, all girls who were born in the village went through female genital mutilations. Nowadays, I talk to my sisters, I talk to my nieces. Maybe if it is practiced, it's maybe underground. It's a minority. So it is a situation that is improving a lot. in Africa today. The same way, for instance, when you talk about Africa, in the United States, people talk about AIDS. Yes, of course, there are AIDS problems in Africa. But do you know that malaria kills more children in Africa than does AIDS? But people don't talk about malaria. They only talk about AIDS because that's what the Western media talk about. It is those kind of distortions in information that I think this kind of event, Africa through African eye, is trying to redress.
Professor Samba Gajigo of Mount Holyoke College, thanks so much for coming to Writer's Voice and telling us about Africa through African eyes. Go to writersvoice.net. We'll have more information about that and links to the website.
Just the Westfield College website.
Mm-hmm. We'll have links to more information about these events. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Jamono di dem di dem batnan li metina.
African salsa from Senegal. That was Super Kayor de Dakar. Well, listeners, that's almost it this week for Writer's Voice. We've just enough time to bring you a clip from our coming attractions. Next week, the focus will be on how parents can help their kids become happier, calmer, and more moral human beings. We'll talk with master teacher Rafe Esquith about his book for parents, Lighting Their Fires, Raising Extraordinary Children in a Mixed Up, Muddled Up, Shook Up World. He's the force behind the world-renowned Hobart Shakespeareans, a troupe of young actors from poor schools in Los Angeles. And Kim John Payne tells us about his book, Simplicity Parenting. Here's a clip from that interview. In your book, Simplicity Parenting, Using the Extraordinary Power of Less to Raise Calmer, Happier, and More Secure Kids, you talk very early on in this book about the four pillars of too much: stuff, choices, information, and the fast pace of living. What do you mean by too much stuff, and what do you mean by too much choices? I'd like to combine those because I think in some ways they're connected.
Well, the four pillars, as you mentioned, the first pillar is that of the environment. You know, like a lot of stuff in the environment, too many toys, too many books, too many clothes, just too much. And so that's the first one. It's kind of the easiest one, really. The second pillar is that of rhythm, of actually strengthening rhythm and predictability in a child's life. And I find that by strengthening rhythm, the children just really thrive on that kind of predictability. And so that's got to do with resiliency and having a child be strong and become who they, the full capacity, basically, of who they can be. Then that third pillar that you mentioned is scheduling and not being really cautious about overscheduling. And the fourth is filtering adult information. A lot of kids are getting unbelievable amounts of adult information now that we never got, Francesca.
Kim John Payne. You can hear him and Rafe Esquith next week right here on Writer's Voice. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.